Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Wednesday, December 21st. We have today Caroline Miller and Ira Harris. Caroline is the Chief Asset Allocation Strategist at Alpine Macro. Prior to joining Alpine Macro, she spent 8 years with BCA Research, Bank Credit Analyst, where she served as Global Strategist and Chief Advocate for the firm's research around the world. She also served in senior roles at UBS Global Asset Management and La Caisse de Dépôt de Placement du Québec, and JP Morgan Investment Management. Ira is independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint most recently. He maintains a blog at iragharris.com. Welcome, Caroline and Ira.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. I thought we'd begin with a focused discussion on a recent interview article that was posted at the beginning of November in a publication called themarket.ch. It's a Swiss publication. They have an English portion as well. And just wondering on that, your thoughts. There was mention of your expectation of inflation and long-term interest rates to fall next year. Can you elaborate on that, Caroline?
Sure. I think we're seeing the beginnings of disinflation now, certainly in the US. If you look at the manufacturing industrial sector, pricing power is certainly coming down. You look at the housing sector, housing activity, transactions, prices, the new prices for the real leading indicator in the rental market, after a big post-COVID surge. And I think that's important because outside of core services, where there's pressure from a tight labor market, housing was one of the few pillars that was really keeping inflation sticky mathematically. So I think disinflation is going to be a big trend next year in the macro landscape. And that's going to coincide with a weaker economy. And that's why I believe that long-term interest rates have peaked and are on a downward trend.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I'm going to, I'm left wondering, and it's not just about the inflation. I think that inflation, the trend is certainly softening a little bit. But at bonds, I'm looking at US 10 years, let's use that, at 3.5% in this environment, I just cannot get myself to be buying them. Now, can I buy 2 years? I can load the wagon up with 2 years at 4.5%, you know, or when we see the curve inverted, I just don't see any value in the 10-year because my issue with the 10-year is, first of all, the Fed's not cutting rates. This concept of a pivot is, to me, ridiculous. Are they going to pause? Sure, but they should pause because, you know, I'm a believer that until you really understand the true impact of quantitative tightening in a heavily leveraged, especially global system, and the system is so leveraged up global, we don't know how this really plays out. We don't know the impact of it. And you could see at the ECB's press conference, Lagarde acquiesced for 4 months to begin quantitative tightening in March of $15 billion, which is less than a trickle. But that's, you know, she's got a whole different situation. She's got a political situation of basically 19 countries who are all responsible for debt and currency, but they don't have a harmonized taxing system. So there's a whole lot of issues going on there. And she has a massive balance sheet that she has to deal with. And she has a group of hawks who are not afraid to be hawkish carping at her. So she's in a different situation. The Fed, I think, has to be careful here and really see the way the quantitative tightening is going to play out here. So I'm not, looking for the curve. I'm looking for the curve to steepen. And I believe it's because there's really no, to me, there's no value in the 10-year. There's no value. I mean, if inflation were to come down quicker than we've ever seen it come down to 3.5%, that puts the long end at zero. You know, if I went back and look for 40 or 50 years, the real yield on 10-year debt in the U.S. is about 2%. We haven't even approached it. You can show me whatever tips you want, but so I'm not looking for it. Will the global economy slow? I don't doubt it. To me, because the huge, you know, we haven't even gotten into the huge debt overhang that has to be financed. So hopefully, we'll go there.
What are your thoughts, Caroline, on the on the U.S. yield curve and the global bond market in general?
Sure. So I want to respond to Ira and first say that I agree the ECB is in a tight spot. I agree that the curve is likely to re-steepen from its exceptionally inverted level, but that could certainly be a bull steepening. And I just want to observe, I also agree that tips may have better prospects than nominals next year. Observe that this year, in fact, in long-term inflation expectations started to drop. The main reason that there was such carnage in the bond market was the rise in real yields. And that was really a function, the biggest driver of changes in the nominal 10-year yield overall is changes in the expected path of Fed policy. And so we saw this 400 basis point rise. Look at the 8th Eurodollar contract. It really lines up with the 10-year. So we saw this colossal shift in the expectation for the future path of Fed policy, all the tightening. And I think you're right, there will be a phase where there's an actual pause, but the market's going to see through that, acknowledge the pause is related to the fact that, hey, policy operates with a lag, and yes, there's a high debt level, and yes, the economy's weakening. The Fed's history of response to recession is rate cuts, and that's going to get what's going to get start to get priced in. And so I think that if you look at the 365 on the 10-year and you compare that to where the Fed funds rate is now, you look at the Fed funds futures curve, there's, I think the market is going to pivot quickly. The market, not necessarily the Fed immediately, the market's going to lead the Fed to pivot from obsessing about inflation to worrying about recession. And that transition is going to necessarily involve an adjustment of the expected future path of Fed funds. And that is going to catalyze an incremental drop in bond yields.
Interesting. What are your thoughts on that path, Ira?
Well, you know, I listen, there's nobody who can say definitively what this path is going to be, because we have never been here before. I know what the Fed is about. And if I see a period in time, it's not Volcker. You know, when I listen to Powell, as I say, he's not searching his inner Volcker. He's searching his inner Andrew Mellon. You know, he wants to liquidate the global asset system because that's going to, you know, the Fed has admitted we can't do anything about supply. The only way they can do anything about supply is to crush demand, which then if you crush demand, yeah, the amount of supply you have, well, it'll come in balance. Okay. So I find that, okay. I get that part of the argument. He had made such a big deal. And I agree with Carolyn about this because he had made such a big deal. That's why I'm not as I say, I don't come to praise Powell. I come to bury him because I can find all kinds of problems with Powell. And the biggest part of the problem, of course, was his bombastic rhetoric. And for him, it was really bombastic, is that we're not ending QE or we're not starting to tighten until everybody who lost a job through no fault of their own. And of course, the rhetoric was picked up by Janet Yellen. Well, I find that reprehensible, by the way, because they kept their foot on the pedal far longer. And now he's put himself in a position, of course, where he's now for posterity, trying to regain his credibility. So yes, he stayed tighter. Will he ease? I don't know. I don't know what he's searching for here. And of course, you know, so I don't know. And it's a global phenomenon. You know, I look at Europe and we saw what happened with the Brits. And now we saw the other night what happened with the Japanese, which I find kind of preposterous, because what the Japanese did really wasn't that. Yes, they changed the yield curve. But if you read what Kuroda had to say, it was 50, negative 50. The range was still 100. And they're still buying ETFs in Japan on the Nikkei, as well as REITs. So, but I see a lot of other problems, especially as Europe ends, and you see it already. The market is doing what the market's supposed to do, attacking the most vulnerable in Europe. You know, that the fact that Italian 10-year rates went over Greek rates, and that spread widened out last in three trading days, 35 basis points. I'm talking about in the German Italian. So the market is looking for these vulnerabilities. How will these vulnerabilities spill over the other global markets? I think is what we're really going to be searching for.
Go ahead, Caroline. Did you want to mention something?
Yeah, sure. I'd just respond and say that I think this is a pendulum issue, and we've gone from $14 trillion U.S. dollars of negative yielding debt to I think we're down to almost zero now, with the 2-year JGB yield creeping above zero. Yeah. But I, you know, similar to the normalization after the financial crisis, let's not learn too much from the pandemic. I don't believe that the paradigm of slower global growth in high-income economies due to demographics and debt is all that is different at all in a post-pandemic world. I think if you regress fiscal intervention from COVID with inflation, you'll see that the countries that handed out a lot of money to households and firms are the ones that have experienced, that were force feeding demand in a period where supply was constrained. That is really not the case in Asia. It is much more of a Europe, North American phenomenon. And if you look at the history of inflation, surges typically are 16 months up the hill and then 16 months down. So, you know, my response is that, I think Ira's right about the global debt burden, but my takeaway from it is that that is inherently disinflationary. Also, with respect to the Fed, I think Powell really wants to retire forward guidance. It's an artifact of the post-GFC world. It was a tool that was used to medicate volatility and prevent any unwanted tightening of financial conditions. You can see that this year, the Fed has been leaning against any unwanted easing of financial conditions. But I also believe that whatever he's saying today is gratuitous and has a very short shelf life. So I don't believe that, to use your word, Ira, bombastic. We're not even thinking about tightening or easing. I sort of dismiss that. I think the data is going to, and the market are going to move the Fed from tightening to pause and pause to ease. And I don't think that anything that comes out of the Fed communique today it fights that.
I think that's a great point. I'm glad you're forward guidance, and I've watched this, and being a Fed, I mean, right. It starts with Bernanke. Well, it actually, let's go back to Michael Woodford, if I believe.
That's right. 2012, right? At Jackson Hole.
And even in his work, he talks about it in 2003 in his book on, you know, his, you know, so I bothered to, you know, right. That's, thank you. You my sentiments exactly. And they picked it up and ran with it because it was under the guise of transparency. Well, you know what? I don't want a transparent central bank. Central banks work best when they keep us on our toes, because that's what the markets, but with that came a lack of respect for markets, or really understanding about markets. And nothing said it more Bernanke's pivot during the taper tantrum of 2013, which I thought was one of the great policy miscues, because the market was doing what he should have wanted the market to do, which was weaning us off of some of this ridiculous, I'm a big believer in QE1. I thought QE1 was a massive stroke of genius because you had to prevent the liquidation of the system. The US political system could not take a liquidation of assets because it would run up to 20, 25% unemployment, as we saw to me in the 30s. We got to very high and we got nowhere nearer to those levels, and the system was potentially shaking because it just cannot deal well with those kind of levels of unemployment. So I understand that, and it was an important thing, but my problem was they didn't know where to stop. If a little is good, a lot must be better. Whether you're, in their famous words, we don't have to worry about an exit strategy. And as Yellen famously said, it'd be like watching paint dry. Well, it's been every time they've tried, it's been anything but, because I don't know that they really bothered to understand, nor do their models allocate to it, how much leverage risk was taking place built on that back, and especially holding rates. And let's face it, the Fed ran interference for the ECB. The Fed was terrified of going to negative. I mean, the market took rates in the US negative, but Europe made a, negative 50 basis points. The Japs negative 10. They front ran that and made it easier for them to do it. Now we're saddled with it and trying to figure it out. But I think your points are very well taken. I just as a trader have to figure out, where are we going here? Where is the market's going to take us here? And I don't care about equity prices, because if I think they're overvalued, they're overvalued. If I think they're undervalued. But it's all in reference to the cost of money anyway, ultimately, because businesses have to borrow. And when that's what I'm afraid of, is that we're going to find out how many firms are borrowed up and how many questionable organizations are borrowed up with these ultra low interest rates that now have to be refinanced. So I know that's where you get to the disinflation, because debt loads have historically been disinflationary. I mean, that is the history of mankind until we get to an ultimate, unfortunately, true fiat currency world where they're so quick to pump rather than allow anything to kind of sort itself out. And I'm not a laissez-faire free market. That only exists, I'm from Chicago, so I would have to go down to 57th and Woodlawn in order to experience it in full blown force. So I'm not preaching that, nor do I believe in that. But they're too quick, and sometimes you got to let some of the pain. Markets work good with some pain.
Would you not argue there's been some pain this year?
There's been pain for certain people who built up positions, and I think rightfully bonds. But people, institutions and others who need to do, who need to build that quote unquote 60-40 portfolio, which I think should go the way of forward guidance, by the way. I'm not a big fan of it, never have been. I believe in flexibility and adaptability rather than, well, this is the way it's going to be, because things, and again, there has been pain, and there's been severe pain. There's more to come, because a lot of it, people buy bonds, and I talk to them all the time. And well, I'll get my money back because they're going to expire at par. Well, not for everybody. There's people who jig around, and as Chris Whalen has done a great job pointing out, there's some banks who may have a little bit more problems than they think, because they're sitting, and if they have to raise cash, they're going to be selling certain assets that they bought with very low coupons that they're going to absorb some significant losses on. So yes, there's been pain for some investors, but it's not the kind of pain that we've seen. It's not the Volcker pain, I know that.
Just coming back to the article, the market article, Caroline, you identified three factors that would make for a sustainably weaker U.S. dollar. One would be peak in U.S. Treasury yields. Number two, narrowing of the current U.S. interest rate advantage over its trading partners. And the third one is a stronger Chinese growth. Can you assess each of those three factors? What are your thoughts on the U.S. dollar?
Sure. So I think the dollar has peaked. In terms of the interest rate advantage and peak treasury yields, those two sort of go together. The Fed was the most aggressive large central bank this year. And as a result, you see that the U.S. interest rate advantage relative to the G10 more broadly has expanded significantly. I think that as Ira alluded to, the ECB is in a slightly different position. The economy is weak, but it's not clear that inflation has peaked in Europe. They're perhaps a couple steps behind the Fed, although moving in the same direction economically. I also would point out the euro is really the anti-dollar. There's tremendously high correlation between the U.S. dollar pair and the U.S. versus the rest of the G10. So as goes the euro, is similar for the Swedish kroner, Canadian dollar, yen. Because I think the U.S. economy is going to lose momentum, perhaps in a nonlinear way, with the lagged effect of all the tightening, that's one pole of it, is the expectation that treasury yields have peaked. And expectations for the resting spot for the Fed funds rate in this cycle have also likely peaked. Even if the Fed funds rate isn't there yet, I don't believe it needs to go to 5 or 6%. I think if you look at the San Francisco Fed's proxy Fed funds rate, it's already over 6 if you count the impact of quantitative tightening. The other pole of the earth, China, there's no question that the US dollar is inversely correlated to the directionality or momentum of China's business cycle. They appear to have finally issued the growth crippling zero COVID policy. They are dismantling all the infrastructure surrounding that, which would imply that there's no, you know, past the point of no return to go back to lockdown. And underneath that, macro policy in China is very easy. So in the US, you have growth slowing from a pretty robust clip and policy tight and getting tighter. And in China, you have the economy on its knees, fiscal and monetary policy very loose, where the transmission mechanism was blocked. Now you have the likely gradual reopening of that economy. I think 6 months from now, that whole part of the world's gonna look a lot stronger. Those are the conditions for a weaker dollar.
That's very insightful. Your thoughts on that, Ira?
Can't agree more. And I throw in, because whenever the West has a huge debt load, I'm just talking about you know, the $30 trillion that we've grown to in the national debt, and you can't raise rates or rates don't go up, they're going to have a problem with this. And I think the strong dollar, I'm one who thinks that the strong dollar has been one of the nastier fallouts from the Fed's quick move and getting out ahead of everybody. I thought they're causing a lot of pain on the globe. You want to talk about pain? The emerging market world has had to race ahead. And I think, Augustin Carstens has been right on top of that. They're really listening to him enough. The emerging markets haven't taken the traditional beating here that they usually take because they raced ahead of the Fed. You know, we got Mexico, where's 9.5, I think. The Brazilians went from 2.5 to 13. So everybody's rushed ahead because they didn't want to get caught off, because a massive amount of dollar funding in the emerging markets is huge. And it acts as a drag on the global economy. So, I mean, I thought the only one who asked a credible question at Brookings was Claudius Sam, who I actually like to listen to quite a bit. And actually, Richard Clarida, one of the few last speeches that he gave before he left the Fed, really had to deal with the third part of the mandate, which was financing the global financial system. So it's been expensive run and a painful run, I think the dollar is going to have some real problems. You saw the movement right off the Japanese yen, which I think it'll correct off of there. But I think the yen has been one of the most undervalued currencies in the world anyway, next to the Canadian dollar. But I think the Canadian dollar suffers from some other things for whatever reasons. But I agree with that. And interest, one of the, I've been a currency trader since 1977, because that was my expertise when I was in graduate school. So I learned, but one of the interesting things is watching the yen yuan as indicative. And I think Asia is going to be a very interesting story. I don't know if it'll play out into the equity markets, but I think, I agree with Carolyn, I think there's going to be a lot. And with the weak yen, I mean, a 150 yen to me was preposterous, is if I could quote Jean-Claude Trichet, you know, that's preposterous. I can't do it with a French accent, but I always love when he would say that, preposterous. But it was 150 yen, that was a pure algorithmic focus on the interest rate differentials. And it took the yen to a level where the Japanese were being able to onshore some manufacturing that they've lost, and nothing more so than the chip business, which is making its way back to, you know, Tokyo Electron, Toshiba. They're moving, and why? Because there's an inherent advantage. So if you're moving out of China, what better place, especially with Asia as being such a growth story for the world going forward this year? But you still have population growth, not China and not Japan, but the other parts, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia. So what better to be able to secure your technological inputs from a Japan, which can compete with a very weak currency? And it was weak also against Europe, especially. You know, I watched that very carefully, and getting the euro yen up to 148 was crazy, but the world did that. But I'm in agreement with Carol. I think the dollar will be a part of the story. We may think so for different reasons, but.
What do you make of that, Caroline? Like the cross.
Well, I would say that I was right. This hasn't been the typical catastrophe for EM, the dollar strength this year. Not sure I agree it's because the EM current central banks were getting out ahead of dollar strength. The fact is, a much bigger part of their consumer price index is food and fuel. And so their inflation surge actually happened faster, the feed through there. And as a result, they were forced to tighten, forced into an aggressive monetary tightening cycle last year, which left them with very high real yields with which to sustain, to, you know, manage the Fed's tightening a little bit better. But I also think that sets EM up for an easing cycle. And I there hasn't been that same transmission mechanism of pain. And the main reason it sets the EM world up for an easing cycle, I'm really talking about Latin America, is that inflation there is absolutely melting. And so you've got China reopening, and scope for rate cuts is I think quite bullish for EM, which is also a point I made in that article. But I agree with Ira, quite right. Japan has regained some competitiveness relative to China with the 50-year. One of my colleagues wrote, the yen is trading at levels not seen since Yoko and John were singing together. So the yen's been a bit of, certainly a coiled spring.
Yep. Would that translate into bullishness on equities of Japanese businesses in like an industrial conglomerates or semiconductors, you think?
Yes, I would say that Japanese equities are cheap. Little known reality, the earnings per share growth performance of Japanese firms has bested the US, and you wouldn't know it based on the savage multiple compression that Japan has experienced over the last generation. I think that's kind of a risk premium associated with the currency volatility. I see Ira holding up an article talking about this. But so profitability is not an issue. It's really what is the catalyst to unlock some of that that purgatory for the multiples. And so the sign of secular stagnation or weak growth in a country where they have to import profits and economic momentum is that you typically don't see Japanese equities rally in a world without a cheap yen or without the yen cheapening. So that then raises the question, hey, if the yen is going to start surging, is that isn't that a headwind for stocks? And I think the answer is yes, but the cushion is so large that as a foreign investor, there's certainly a cyclical opportunity to get on the China reopening, rotation of global growth momentum to the East bandwagon at a rock bottom level with the cheap yen and an environment where Japan's economy is going to experience a lift. So yes, but I don't think there's any case to be made for any kind of structural expectation that Japan's going to become a global growth locomotive again. So important distinction there.
Yes, I agree with that. But here's, because I've been running these numbers, because I've been looking at this, and I pointed up a story from Minichi, Japan corporate, the headline was a corporate Japan profits hit July SEP record, CapEx up 9.8%. Those are significant numbers. And when, I know that they create these rooms where, okay, the yen is stronger, Nikkei is weaker. And we saw it right after the BOJ the other night. I mean, I'm using this as an opportunity to actually get long Nikkei as we sit here. And I've been long Tokyo Bank for 8 years. It's dead money. It's ridiculous. But it's like owning a bond. It's gone nowhere. I've been long from $3.50 and it pays 4%, 5%, 6%. This year it's paying a 5%. So, okay, I haven't made any money, but it was certainly better than putting my money into a US or Canadian bank. That much I know of. And it's poised. It's really, if you want to look at stuff that's poised to wind. But here, the yen is still 13% lower on the year versus the dollar. It's lower against the euro. It's lower against currencies. And yet the Nikkei is still down 10% for the year. So you said there's room for it to correct here. And that's, where can it go? Everybody talks about stock markets. Well, 1989, 1990, the Nikkei was at 40,000. We've been down to 8, and it's sadder. So if there is some onshoring, especially in the more dynamic type of industries, I think Japan could capture that. And if I look at what's better of yen, it was before COVID, the Japanese were geared at about 105, right? The Japanese corporations, they always put out their predictions about where the yen is going to be and how they're going to be able to over in that world because they're very sensitive to it. So it's interesting. I agree wholeheartedly with that. And I think Japan will be able, and when it breaks away from that algorithm correlation, that it will be able to itself actually in Asia. And as there was that wonderful article in Observing Japan the other day, written by my son, who's a Japanese, he works at the German Marshall Fund as their Japan expert or Asian expert. So he wrote and Japan is ramping up defense spending and they're doing it domestically. This is a whole nother arena that we're going to get into. So it's worth looking at and it changes what has been a long held view. So it's making the case as to what I want to be bullish about, but you look at the Japanese banks, which used to dominate the, I'm going back, of course, 30 years when dominated the international landscape. Everybody, the United States banks got in trouble because they wanted to get great supermarket banks of the, how I would say probably best is where Carolyn came, UBS. I think UBS is going back to its knitting and managing people health and stop trying to Goldman Sachs. I think far better for it, but I'm an Axel Weber fan. So when I see him there, I get comfortable.
And Caroline, what's your assessment elsewhere in Asia for asset allocation? Do you see risks due to the China-Taiwan geopolitical situation? What are your thoughts like on Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, you know, for or even Hong Kong?
So I think there's, you know, going to be a general lift to the whole area from the re-engagement of China in the global economy. I think the geopolitical temperature of the world is high. That's not news. That's well understood in terms of the U.S.-China strategic rivalry. I think that the one of the key reasons, actually, that that China has, you know, catalyst for issuing the zero COVID policy was the reality that exports had been one of the few bright lights in their economic performance in the last few years. Exports to Europe and Asia, reports of the death of that trade flow are greatly exaggerated. But now that that trade flow is slowing for cyclical reasons, and, you know, this is creates a vacuum and a reason for China to now have no choice but to reboot its domestic demand. And that's going to have implications for, you know, what's extraordinary is when you see a country like China, they have been, their export volumes and total value of exports to the US and Europe have been slowing, and yet their trade balance is still soaring. That tells you, trade surplus, excuse me, is still soaring, tells you just how weak import appetite has been. And so, a floor there is good for the Indonesias, the Malaysias, all of China's suppliers and customers. Yeah. And that's a reason to be more constructive on the outlook for equities in that region. That said, I think Taiwan is still one of the more expensive markets. I think the LATAM space, this is going to be bullish for commodities. And LATAM versus Asia in terms of forward multiples, LATAM is still cheaper. But the whole EM space is going to have a lift from a more vibrant and more balanced Chinese economy. And China itself, gosh, I got this question yesterday. Well, they've had a rally. You need a microscope to see that, my friend. The sentiment and global, the global bludgeoning and abandoning of Chinese assets has been such that, you know, you're still looking at two or three sigma cheap relative to the rest of the EM complex for Chinese equities directly.
Mm-hmm. Great points. Yeah. Your thoughts, Ira?
No, I one of the economists who I really like and read a lot is Michael Pettis. And I think when it comes to China, Michael Pettis, and we did, Richard, we did we actually did a podcast with Pettis.
Beijing,
He invited me to speak at the university, but it'll be a while before I get over to China for good reason. But I think Pettis's point has always been that is, and we saw it during COVID when the yuan was, you know, everybody was looking for a weaker yuan because China would force its currency lower to protect its export sector, which has been the model. But the yuan went higher, and it really led. We talked about in this podcast with Louis Gavet. We had real time discussions about the and with Pettis because it allowed China by strengthening the yuan. China was able to stockpile massive amounts because they were buying everything cheaper. And everybody was fighting for market share and they were going up. So they everything collapsed, of course, because everybody thought we were going into this massive global depression. And the thing, so commodity prices were under pressure. The Chinese were acquiring everything and they were using a stronger yuan to do it. Now, and it fit Pettis's view on, of course, on if you're going to develop a more middle-class oriented, consumer-oriented society, you need a stronger currency. And they did that very well. Mm-hmm. Then things started getting a little shaky in the markets. And of course, we went up to what, about 7.25 on the yuan to the dollar. Now we're down to 6.98. So But and Louis Gavet says that they're actually starting to buy. I know that's one of Louis's recent discussions. So it'll be interesting. And I think Carolyn is dead right on the commodities, not just from inflation, that there's just needs out there. And China has needs. And China, and I think her view on Latin America is 100% right. Brazil is sitting in a catbird seat. And even with Lula, you know, forget that, because Lula was a pretty good steward of the economy. Now, is he going to come more with an angry leftist bent? I don't think so. I think he's very reasoned and you know, and I don't have skin in the game. I'm just watching it because the Brazilians have been very good at lifting a lot of trade from the U.S. grain markets. I mean, nobody produces more soybeans than the Brazilians, and nobody needs more corn and soybeans than the Chinese, and nobody can process them cheaper. So it's a really nice relationship, and they build it very well, and the Chinese use that. They use it against the United States. It was one of the stupid things that Trump did when he rushed to put tariffs on, because what did the Chinese do? They went and punished the American farmer. We were moving back to the politics of the 50s with the John Birch Society, when they were trying to, you know, support, of course, Chiang Kai-shek, and the American farmers were going crazy because they were writing off the massive amount of food that China, you know, it's a stupid, and that was a really stupid part of the Trump, under Peter Navarro, I didn't expect much more, but the American farmer, which they had spent a fortune building a marketing and building market share in China, and they just ripped it out from under them. And the Brazilians were there with the ability, and now the Brazilians produce far more beans, especially than the U.S. does. So, big supplier, I agree with you.
Sorry, you were going to say something, Caroline? Go ahead.
As far as Lula goes, he has been a better global citizen than Bolsonaro. So this is an upgrade, A. And B, he's not, you know, there's a balance of power in Brazil. The Congress is actually quite conservative, which is going to rein him in. So I think for the reasons Ira highlighted, and for that reason, gridlock in Brazil will actually be pretty constructive for markets there.
Do you know, is Fraga still around? Is he in Brazil, Fraga, who was the head of the, you know, he was really good.
I haven't heard his name lately.
Yeah, no, neither have I. But he was a pretty good, even though he came out of Soros's group, I'm all against him. But no, he was a really astute banker. And they need astute. In Mexico, Agustin Carstens was, I think, a wonderful central banker. And I think the Mexican central bank has really done a pretty good job, which is, that's one of the big shifts, is that you really, you know, and I'm not going back to Chile, that's a whole different story, but you've had pretty good central bankers to the emerging world. I think they've learned a lot of lessons, and it's helped outside Turkey, but that's a whole different discussion.
And other countries in Latin America that may be of interest, Caroline, like what about Argentina, Colombia, Chile?
Argentina, I think 80% inflation is sort of uninvestable there. I think the real yields in Colombia are attractive. But I would say that just Latin America in general, as Ira pointed out, has seen significant rate hikes and is now experiencing rapid disinflation. That's a very constructive mix for bond yields. I'd also point out the other reason there's been less contagion, if you will, from all this dollar strength is that many of these countries are borrowing in their own currencies now. And so the comparison with the 80s and even the 90s, they've got open capital accounts. Most of them have seen the advantage of fiscal religion, and they're self-funding. And so the immediate expectation that it's, you know, our currency, but your problem, I actually believe that the Fed's low on the Fed's list in terms of financial stability concerns is Latin American funding or emerging market debt. I think the private markets have been a cumulative repository for rent seeking in the liquidity space related to the low rate decade. And that would be an area where I would see the mark to market could be nonlinear and make more waves next year. It doesn't make sense that the private equity marks are down 4 or 5 year to date and public market small caps are down 30 to 40.
And in your asset allocation process, do you provide consideration or how do you provide consideration for the potential of like resource nationalization, government nationalizations, those type of risks? Especially in emerging markets.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to add on that. I would say that capacity constraints related to years of chronic underinvestment on the public, from a public and private perspective, mm-hmm. in everything that looks like a fossil fuel is highlighting how expensive and how long this green transit energy transition is going to take and be. And so I think there's a long runway for higher price public and private assets in that yeah. space. I think markets, I'm not sure how much they price the nationalization risk. It's going to be a function of where is their capital, and capital will flow when the prices are attractive enough, and the prices will become attractive when the shortages remain acute.
Yeah, that's good points. Yeah, thoughts, Ira?
No, I sums it up beautifully, I think so.
And what about just on the U.S. Equity markets, thoughts there, 6 to 12 months out?
Yeah. So I think some interest rate relief is going to cause will help reverse some of the multiple compression. But I think there's likely to be a leadership rotation away from the large cap mega tech. I also think a lot of the pandemic winners aren't going to have the huge bounce that people expect. The linear extrapolation of growth in the high double digits for a lot of businesses that benefited from lockdown, supply bottlenecks, work from home, et cetera, those valuations can't be an anchor point. I think on the other hand, a lot of small caps have gotten crushed from inflation. Disinflation tends to breathe life back into those margins. So I think there's some potential rotation of leadership to small cap. I also think that markets don't discount recession twice, and you've seen a major reversal of the expectation for the trend in earnings growth. And most the bear narrative is, well, the recession hasn't even started and we're going to have our earnings contraction and stocks are going to make new lows. But that ignores the reality that we started this conversation with, which is that bond yields aren't going to sit at 360 in a recession. And in fact, if you look at the evolution of the bear market in the 70s, an inflationary driven equity bear market bottoms when rates and inflation peak. You don't actually need huge easing to get recovery. That was the case in the mid 70s. Earnings per share peaked, inflation peaked, rates peaked. The bear market in the equity space had already taken place, and we could 6 months from now be look back here and say this was the third and fourth quarter of 2022 was the bottoming process.
Yeah, that's a great analogy, great observation. Your thoughts, Ira?
It's a view that I'm going back to the late 70s. You know, I find it I can't stand that phrase finding my inner Volcker, because if I look at Volcker couldn't have been Volcker with the huge amount of debt that he had to contend with. You know, when Volcker went on that path, the debt to GDP ratio in the US was about 39%. We're nowhere near that. Mm-hmm. And if you squeeze that, to me, you are going to unleash some ugly political forces anyway, because now you're going to talk about the discretionary spending programs, what gets spent. And as I caution people, when the interest on the debt exceeds the defense budget, which of course in the United States is astronomical, you are going to run into severe, severe problems. And we're a lot closer to that, because that's just, because then everybody will be carping at each other about how we're going to spend money, especially now we have a divided Congress. So the acrimony and recriminations are going to be far greater than we've seen. And this is not something to me that I take lightly. This is a very important aspect and hangs over the investment world. Now, I don't get bearish equities like a lot of people do, because presently, if we stay with real yields being negative, it's hard not to look for things to buy. You know, it's not like, you know, again, inner Volcker, yeah, the real yield on overnight debt probably went to 6 or 7%, maybe 8%, and it's to squeeze the inflation out of the system. You're not going to see that. There's not any way, shape, or form will you ever see that play out again. I don't believe it. It's just the world has changed so dramatically, and with that comes, you have to be very agile in the way that you're going to invest. And because when real yields, if there's zero would, I'll tell you what, if we get to zero real yields, or as Powell's talked about, he would like to get to 1% real yield on overnight money. Then I think the equity markets go down to some level. Will we make new lows? No, but I think we see a much sizable correction. And then that's where I'm a buyer at, and I'm a sizable buyer of U.S. equities at that time. But if they were to do that, but I don't think we're going to get that. And I think people who are pushing the bear side had better be careful and really watch the effectiveness of real yields on the overall investment picture.
I think stocks are a long duration asset, and I don't know that the overnight yield is the relevant discount factor.
It's, you know, I'm reiterating what Powell brought to the table, and he's talked about it. You know, he would like to get Fed funds to an effective real yield. You know, he puts on his John Taylor hat, but that hat doesn't fit very well.
But that can happen one of two ways. He can keep tightening, or inflation can plummet and he can do nothing.
Right. And he's hoping for the latter, of course.
Yes.
Their prices drop dramatically. Believe me, if inflation...
They don't have to drop. They just need to stop rising.
Right, right. And where you started out on the owner's equivalent rent, and I mean, that trapped them last year, because everybody saw, I mean, Peter Buchvar and Jimmy Bianco talked prolifically about it, that, hey, you're looking at these numbers, they're just wrong. And it's a lag. If there's anything that lags, it's, of course, the owner's equivalency rent and the way it plays into the system. And now it's lagging the other way. I know, I see it where I live. You know, I know that's all anecdotal, but we'll see what's going on in Canada, which has had a very interesting market. And they ran to an inversion on the 210 curve of 1%. Yeah, they've come off quite a bit with everybody else of late, but wow, that was really, and that was with Macklin being a little bit more cautious in his latest missive. So it'll be interesting to watch.
Well, great. It's been an insightful, interesting discussion. Any final thoughts, Caroline? And also, how can our listeners, viewers learn more about your work?
Sure. So alpinemacro.com is our website, and we're Canadian based but globally oriented. I think that the Canadian housing market has been in certain markets much frothier, but the underlying structural need for housing puts a floor under that. There's also a lot more equity in homes. There's always been much tighter, more responsible lending standards and underwriting up here, requirement for mortgage insurance. And so I believe that this tightening cycle is going to generate a correction, not an apocalypse.
I agree with that. You know, most people don't understand. That's why during the great financial crisis, the Canadian banks basically went unscathed. They had 20% skin in the game. And even with variable mortgage, well, the variable mortgages, now they're hurting them a little bit as rates go higher. But it's not, as you point out, not necessarily a bad thing. But people say, oh, I hear all these apocalyptic prognostications about the Canadian. I said, no, the housing market operates differently. Yes, they never really corrected, but they didn't have to correct like we did, because people had a lot more. There was no mailing in your keys. You had way too much equity to do that. So that's a really great point. Thanks.
Great. And yeah, also just to mention, Ira has the blog, iragharris.com, where our listeners.
Notes from underground, where 2+2 doesn't equal, where 2+2 = 5 from Dostoevsky is also a very beautiful thing. That's the world in which I live, very unbalanced, as you can tell. So this was great. I really appreciate this.
Great. Thank you so much, Caroline.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great. I'm going to start reading your stuff regularly, because I loved, you know, it's a very well thought out view. And it's like I tell people, I said, I'm not here to be validated. If you come to the markets for validation, you're in the wrong place.
Thank you so much for your time, for having me on your roundtable. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. Take care. Yeah. Bye-bye.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.